So, good evening, everybody. We're going to continue our practice on the Eightfold Path with the right intention this month. I'm kind of disappointed because I didn't have enough time to find a whole bunch of little quotes. I really like that. It seems like if I put the little quotes in there, I can flow better. So I didn't have time to find a whole bunch of them, and so we'll have to put them in next week when we do the kind of the summary. But if we talk a little bit about intention and this right intention, it's the second step in the Eightfold Path. So in this path, this is the second step. If you think of the path as three parts. This is the wisdom part. Starting next month, we're going to go into the conduct part, and then Tim's going to end with the concentration, mindfulness, effort, concentration. So we're right here at the beginning, and we're starting with wisdom. And last month, we talked a lot about right view. So right intention is the middle between right view and right conduct. I do want to say, though, actually next month, I'm just giving you a heads up. Tim and I are going to take this out of order. So usually you just follow the path in order. Right view, you practice with that, get to know that. Right intention, you practice with that, you get to know that. After right intention, it would be right conduct, right action, which is, it makes sense because we're going to talk a lot about intention versus action and conduct. But I volunteered to do right livelihood next month since it's my last month. And I mean, right livelihood? I mean, it just seems like it's nothing. I'm going to try to figure something out with it, but Tim is going to do the harder one of right conduct, and I'm going to take the easier one of right livelihood. So it's all livelihood, conduct, and speech are all under the morality conduct part together, but we're just going to take those two out of order. But anyway, this right intention is also called right thought. Sometimes you'll read about it, it'll be called right thought. Sometimes you'll read about it, it'll be called right aspiration. And sometimes you read and it'll be called right resolve. So right intention, right thought, right resolve, right aspirations, all basically the same thing. It's all around this right intention. So if I take a step back here and I think about when I first came into the practice, I really just wanted to get my conduct right. And I'm going to have to talk to Tim about this just to make sure we're both kind of on the same page. But I think I've told you guys, I really think this is not about conduct. This is really about energy. And the more I look at this, read through, practice with, reflect on, contemplate on these eight on this Eightfold Path, the more I think this idea of conduct gets in the way of that. And so when I think about when I first started doing this talk, I thought, okay, when I first came into the practice, what I really wanted to do was fix my conduct. I really was not thinking that there was anything wrong with the way I looked at the world, the way I thought in the world. I thought it was just bad habits. I had these bad habits, and if I could just get the bad habits fixed, then I would be a better person, everything would be good. I'd be happier, everything would be fine. And so that's what I came into the practice, this idea that the practice was going to somehow make my conduct better. I think this is what everybody does. I think this is what we do. We see conduct and think suffering arises out of that conduct. So if I just fix the conduct, then suffering would cease. It's the way we raise our kids. I mean, I paid more attention to what my boys did than I did what they were thinking about in the world. All I wanted to do, if they were sitting still, doing what they were told, not causing any problems, I'm good. Everything's good. We're all happy. But you can think about it with like these school shootings and all this violence that happens. And the first thing people say is, I just can't believe they were doing that. They weren't like anything like that. So we're not really thinking about anything other than how the conduct looks. And so if kids are looking like they're good in school, behaving, not really saying nothing to nobody, not causing any problems, we're like, everything's good. Everybody's happy. It's all good. So it's all conduct. And we get stuck in thinking that it's the conduct that's causing our suffering. It's the actions of someone else or what I do, that's what's causing the suffering. So I'm kind of venturing out there and saying that is not true. It is not our conduct. And I know, I could be venturing a little far, but if you think about it, if I had the capacity right now, in truth, to shift everything that you thought was bad conduct, and I could take it away and turn it into good conduct. If I could just change all that, what we think of as bad conduct, shift it. Now everybody's going to be doing good conduct. Do we think suffering would go away? And the more I think about this, the more I realize, 10 seconds, it would start all back up again. Because the conduct is not what's driving all this suffering we're doing. It's the energy behind that conduct. And even if you shifted all that conduct, it would start right back up again. We would still have all the things in the world that we think we should get rid of. Everybody should be fair. There should be more equality, more kindness towards each other. All of this conduct behavior, we could shift it and it would start right back up again. Because behind all that conduct is something else. And that's the point of looking at this right conduct. If you don't understand the nature of it, where the conduct's coming from, you don't see how conduct arises. You don't see where something is coming from in the moment that it's arising. Then we get stuck in trying to stop and fix and correct and change conduct. And we get caught in that, constantly trying to fix it. And it constantly coming back around. So tonight's talk is really about, how could we look at the harm and the behavior that happens from a different lens? From a lens that's not based in trying to see, trying to fix or get conduct right. So I'm going to do this generally, so I want to give three ways to look at it from three great teachers. And the first one is Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's a senior Western monk. So, well, all these guys, I think, are all senior Western monks. This is the first senior Western monk. It's Bhikkhu Bodhi. So if we think back, put this in framework, we're talking about the Four Noble Truths. We've been talking about it all year, and we talked about how this idea that there is suffering, this understanding that suffering is the natural state of the way that we live in the world as humans, and that there's a cause or an origin of that suffering. And we practiced with, how could I investigate the origin, this craving origin of this suffering. And we talked about that there actually is a cessation of suffering, and that the Eightfold Path is the way leading to that cessation. So if we take that framework, then we're in this path, and in this path, the wisdom aspect, view and intention, is designed to help us penetrate this understanding of suffering, to penetrate into the nature of the way things are and to see things as they actually are. So we're looking at what we perceive, our perception about our world, our lives, all of that. And when we do this looking, like we did last month, we're kind of penetrating through what it is that we're looking at and trying to see it much more clearly. What Bhikkhu Bodhi says is that this investigation that we do in right view restructures our values. That's what he calls it. He says that investigating, so the way to think about it is, if anything happens, something shows up in your life, some irritation, it's always great when it's irritation because we never challenge when things are going good. I've tried, it's very hard, but whenever something's going wrong, I don't have any problem saying, what's going on? Something's messed up. So if you just come it from that lens, something's going wrong. If we, instead of immediately trying to fix the behavior, just begin to look at what is it that's causing this sense that something's going wrong. What Bhikkhu Bodhi says is that act of investigating, that deep reflection on the way things are, the difficulty we're having, that is like restructuring our values. And in this restructuring of the values, there is a way that we are propelled forward, and that propulsion in the mind is the intention. It's the intention that ultimately changes our conduct. And so if you look back on practice, those of you that have been practicing for a while, you look back on practice, you may notice that your behavior, your conduct, the way you are, the way you even think in life is completely different than it used to be, or dramatically different. And yet, if you were to try to pinpoint, when did this turn happen? When did something shift and I could see and experience the world in a different way? When did that happen? You may not be able to pinpoint at all, because it is this restructuring of our values that comes from not this forced trying not to behave a certain way, and more about the investigative, deep reflection on the view that we are holding a particular moment in. That view, the next step then, is this intention that arises out of it. What his restructured propulsion, I'm calling that right intention. So Ajahn Sumedho is another Western monk from Thailand. He says it completely different. So Bhikkhu Bodhi is more of a scholar. Ajahn Sumedho, regular monk, abbot, he says that just consider how dissatisfied we are in life most of the time. And then consider how dissatisfied everybody is in life most of the time. So there's all this dissatisfaction that we kind of just live with every day, all the time. And we do, this dissatisfaction shows up over most of just our everyday life stuff going on. We're used to it. But if we were content, we wouldn't be caught in all this worry about stuff going on in life. If we had a sense of contentment, generally, we wouldn't be caught in all of the, why is this happening? What's going on? It's the dissatisfaction that kind of stirs us up, gets us caught into worrying. So he says, that right intention is the aspiration to want to know the truth about why am I dissatisfied. Not the fixing of the dissatisfaction, but the aspiration or the wanting to kind of know the truth of that. It's in that wanting to know the truth that gets us to begin to question what's actually happening. It's what turns us towards the view. It's what turns us towards our perception and away from conduct and looking more at what's actually going on that makes this moment, whatever that moment is. That's what we're looking towards. So then I have one more. This would be from the Buddha himself. So there's a sutta. It's called the Two Thoughts. I love this sutta. I didn't bring it with me, but anyway, in this sutta, the Buddha divided his thoughts up into two categories. He looked at thoughts. He noticed that some thoughts were based in greed, desire, aversion, and delusion. And some thoughts were based in renunciation, goodwill, and non-harm. And when he looked at them a little even closer, he noticed that the ones that were based in the greed and aversion and delusion, they led to more suffering. And the ones that were not led to less suffering. So then he began to dwell on and keep his mind towards the thoughts around renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. And when he put his mind on that, and he leaned his mind towards that, inclined his mind towards that, that ultimately the suffering began to diminish. So, I'm totally lost on the page here. So give me a second. Never happens, because I don't usually read what I wrote. So Bhikkhu Bodhi, I like what he calls Buddha's efforts in doing that, the process of substitution of thought. So I want to point out three things about this, because I think this is amazing. First, the sutta means that Buddha was thinking during his meditation. This two-thought sutta comes right before Buddha's enlightenment. So he is on his way to enlightenment, and he is thinking. So can we just let that whole thinking thing go away? Because even he was thinking. Second thing, in order for him to divide his thoughts into two categories, right? He had to have thoughts about greed and aversion and delusion, right? So all those desirous, aversive, deluded thinking you have, it's all good, because Buddha had it too. So we can let that part go. So we can all agree that we can have both thoughts that are going to lead us to suffering and thoughts that are going to lead us to less suffering. It's not in the thought, thinking of thought as conduct. It's not the conduct. It's the looking at what's behind that, where the energy behind it, what propulsion it does. So then the third thing is that Buddha could not have judged his thoughts, or he wouldn't have been able to just investigate what those thoughts did. He wouldn't be able to investigate thoughts that lead to less suffering and thoughts that lead to suffering. He would have been caught in judging the thoughts that lead to suffering, which is where we get caught so much. We We have these thoughts in our minds, and then we catch ourselves judging that. But instead, it is when you're thinking about wisdom and you're thinking about view and intention, you are looking at you're investigating, contemplating, reflecting on the nature of what it is that you see, not judging whether what you see is good or bad. I swear, I cannot believe that Buddha did this on his own. I cannot believe that. I mean, we have the advantage because we can read all these books, and we can read what he did, and we can talk to other people, and listen to teachers, and listen to Dhamma talks on Dhamma Seed forever. And he is just sitting there having the idea to divide his thoughts. Rather than just be caught in them, he had this idea, I'm going to divide these thoughts. What Bhikkhu Bodhi calls that is the process of thought substitution. So the last thing I want to talk about is these three areas of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness, and think about the act of thought substitution. What would that mean? What would that look like? I just want to talk about it generally tonight. And then next week, we'll kind of do a summary of this, and we'll talk a little bit about the implications connected to it. And then I think in the last half of the month, if I'm still thinking the same way, I really want to pay more attention to how we specifically practice with all three of these areas. Because these three areas are really the areas that is our intention. It's whether or not we're, it's the three fun, I always call them vows, but the three fundamental things that we are trying to restructure our value system around is renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. So if we look a little bit at renunciation first. So renunciation is supposed to be the remedy to greed or desire. Greed feels like such a harsh word, and often we don't want to see what we're doing as greed. We'd rather, I mean, we probably soften the blow a little bit with desire and think, oh, it's just desire, you know, it's just a wanting. And we don't really like to see it as greed. But I think I told you guys a story a while back ago that I had this monastic that's a friend, and he was trying to get me to understand what is liking. If I see something I like, what is that? And I didn't really quite, something I like. That's pretty much what I thought. I didn't know what the answer should be. So he goes, well, what do you see something you don't like? You know, I thought that's just something I don't like. And he was helping me see that if you see that something you like, then that is greed in the mind. Because inherently our minds will convince us that something it sees is good. So the thing is good. And we don't see that what is deciding something to be good is coming from our own minds. We put it in whatever the object is that we look at or hear or whatever. So in order to begin to see how renunciation actually works as a remedy for this greed and hatred, we sort of have to start with this understanding, this fundamental understanding that we are all seeking happiness all the time. That there's no way around that idea that we are going to seek happiness. We are going to seek happiness. Every single one in this room, every single one, even if I were to decide I'm going to change my whole life into some way of, you know, I'm going to live minimally and just change my eating, the food I eat, everything. We could change it. But it is in this idea that we think if I change all these things, I'm going to be happy. There's all this constant seeking of happiness. In fact, I think that seeking of happiness is ingrained in our DNA. So it's not going anywhere and it's not changing. Mostly, if we don't pay attention to this idea that we are constantly and forever seeking happiness, then we let the mind seek out that happiness. Our thinking mind will search it out for us. And we get caught in the mind's view of what is going to make us happy and what is, in fact, happiness. Then we can see that if the mind sees ice cream and it thinks ice cream is great, then it wants the ice cream because ice cream is great. The mind won't necessarily, our thinking mind won't necessarily look at ice cream for its benefits it may not be so good at all. It won't look that way. It will just see what it likes and think that that is the good. Let me see if I can. I feel like I want to go one more step deeper into this. Every single thing, everything that you like, that I like, is all greed. It's all greed in the mind. It's all desire in the mind. Every single thing. I like getting online to I go to Insight, Access to Insight, and I pull it up and I put a word in the search engine. And I just read whatever comes up. And I just read and read and read. And then if I save it, I'll like that. And then I'll put another word in and I'll just read and read and read. I'm so happy. It's all Dhamma. That's not greed. But that is greed in the mind. It's this wanting, 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 wanting. If you begin to hold it that broadly so that you could begin to see anytime you like something, that is what is thought of as greed and desire in the mind. Then you can begin to open up and see the effects of this. So what you're trying to do is see if you can see that the liking of something is not in the something, but in your own mind. If you can begin to see that the liking of something is in your own mind, you can see the habitual, cyclical nature of wanting and gratification, wanting and gratification, wanting and gratification. The mind will not think of the dangers or the limitations on what it wants because it doesn't have the view to see any limitations on it, given that it thinks the goodness is inherent in the object it likes. And so there's no ability to see that there's anything limiting. It will just constantly over and over and over want, 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 want. The only way to sort of begin to see the dangers, the limitations, the suffering, craving nature of that constant wanting and gratification, wanting and gratification, is going to come through restraint. It's going to come through some kind of renunciation. Not restriction, renunciation. It's going to come from the restraint of the sensual desires, so that we don't get caught in just letting the mind go with whatever it thinks. It's good, it's good, it's good, it's good. Basically, if you use Bhikkhu Bodhi's substitution, the process of thought, what did he call it? Process of thought substitution, is then the practice would be substituting that constant thought of wanting and gratification with a thought on renunciation, which is connected to understanding the limitations and the danger. It's not so much that if you look at renunciation, you won't want anything pleasurable anymore. Because like I said, the mind is forever going to seek pleasure. It's always going to seek happiness. So there's no way that you're not going to be seeking happiness. What you're going to begin to do as we practice more is to see the true nature of that thing that the mind thinks is good, and we can see its limitations. In the goodwill, that is supposed to be the remedy. It's actually goodwill and harmlessness, but I want to, it says goodwill and harmlessness. Both of them are the remedies for aversion or anger. But I'm just going to talk about goodwill as a remedy for this aversion or anger, or it's where ill will is, and talk about harmlessness as something else. But this is another one of those situations where most of us, including myself, we do not want to see our own anger and aversion. And we do not want to see how trapped we are in our own aversion and anger. It's much easier if we can see that the reason why I'm having this anger or aversion is because of something else. It's not just made up in my own mind. That doesn't make any sense. I'm mad, I'm upset because of something someone else did. And if they would fix their conduct, or if this situation would change the way it is, I would not have any aversion and anger. So in this idea of paying attention to our intentions around it, paying attention to that, then we want to begin to see the same habitual nature. The thing about aversion and anger that gets us trapped in this habitual cyclical thing is the creation of enemies. The creation and the nature of enemies. Aversion or this anger, it could be envy, it could be resentment, it could be bitterness. I mean, we know people. We know in our own self certain things that we just have a bitter energy about. The thing could have happened 10 years ago, and we still, whenever we think about it or talk about it, there's a bitterness, an irritation about it. And instead of questioning into that, we will just stay with it because we think the reason why we have that bitterness, that anger, that edge, is because of the other person, the enemy. It's because of that, not anything to do with me. If that person's conduct or if that situation was not the way it is, I wouldn't have all this irritation or anger. So we kind of convince ourselves that our ill will, our aversion, our anger is all justified. And it's reasonable given the situation. Sometimes we say things like, it's not my fault. Or, I didn't mean to cause any harm. Right? It wasn't my intention for this result to happen. And we think, well, if it wasn't, I didn't intend for that result to happen. It's not my fault that all this stuff is going on here. I mean, I'm trying to do the best I can. But if your conduct wasn't so bad, you weren't an enemy, I wouldn't do the things that I do. So there's this cyclical way that our thinking mind basically justifies this way in which we cause this aversion and this anger becomes inherent in a situation, and again, we don't think we are causing it. But all you have to think about is, anything, or I should say, everything you don't like is aversion, hatred in the mind. Everything, anytime, every time something arises and you don't like it, then it's, can you take a moment to contemplate, this is aversion in the mind. This is hatred in the mind, because the thing that you don't like is not inherently bad. I know that's probably going to cause some problems to say that. No, I already know. I've thought about this though. And I just think that if we could begin to see how the mind creates enemies, creates the wrong, creates the sense that something's wrong, we can begin to see where it is that that intention comes from, where you can see how the intention of goodwill actually is a remedy for this. The process of thought substitution that Bhikkhu Bodhi suggests that you think about is you apply metta. So you apply this metta to a situation, a metta being the kindness or friendliness. I just think of metta not so much in the loving kindness sense, but in the actual kindness side. So if you apply kindness even in situations where the mind is thinking, there's an enemy here, something's wrong here, and you substitute that enemy with this idea of kindness and goodwill, it's in that substitution that you begin to see that something happens to the world. It's not in the changing of the conduct, but it'll be difficult to see that. It's counterintuitive. Everything about us thinks that if you fix the conduct, you won't be an enemy. These people or these situations won't be an enemy. So the way I see this is, it's like an inward substitution. I would think this, when you're applying metta to ill will, it's an inward substitution. We're not trying to understand aversion. This is my thoughts about this. We're not trying to understand aversion or anger. There might be a therapeutic way for understanding, or therapeutic sense for understanding anger and aversion. But in this Dhamma practice, we're not trying to understand. It's more that we're trying to cut off the trigger that creates retaliation and enemies. It's not an understanding as much as it is. In desire, you want to understand. You want to understand the mind's wanting and grasping and clinging. In aversion, you want to cut off that trigger that says, I have to seek retaliation. Because there may be something that's happened that's wrong. It's the wanting to seek the retaliation that is difficult, that you're trying to cut that energy off. And then the last one is harmlessness. And I think of harmlessness in the way it's talked about in all the commentaries. Harmlessness is like compassion. It's the act of having compassion towards another person. And it's always really talked about in terms of the remedy for anger and aversion. But I want to just say quickly, I just have a little bit of time here. So I just want to say that I think that this harmlessness is more towards the delusion aspect of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's more towards that root of delusion. Because I think of harmlessness as the outward substitution of thought. It means that we start paying attention to the results of our conduct. I mean, the results of our thoughts and our actions and how we are in the world. It's connected to seeing pain and suffering. So that's why I think it's connected to compassion. It's in our willingness to, instead of close off from pain and suffering, in harmlessness, you're willing to see pain and suffering and feel into the harm that's either caused, that you feel for other people or you feel from your own actions. And in the seeing of that is how we begin to make this kind of inward turn not to cause harm. So basically, I want to talk more about harmlessness, goodwill, and renunciation as actual practices in the second half of the month, but I want us to see if we can all just kind of look and feel into the distinction between desire and greed and renunciation, seeing the distinction between the two. And you can do that pretty much any time there's anything you like. Can you see that there's a wanting or there's a leaning into or a sensual pleasantness about it, like a pleasingness that the mind is doing? When the object itself is neutral and it's not good or bad, pleasing or not pleasing, right, not wrong. In the goodwill, can you see whenever you feel this sense of ill will in any situation, even in the people that you just know are wrong, it's just flat out wrong, can you open up and see that that sense of wrongness is coming from your own thoughts about the way things should be and your own sense of right or wrong? And then in harmlessness, can we just begin to be willing to see the harm, feel into the harm that people go through? And in particular, it's watching our own conduct and seeing the future harm that happens by things that we say. Just not to judge it, just to not to fix it, not to do anything about it, but to see and feel into the harm of it. So I want to end with a quote from Tanisaro Bhikkhu. I really like the way he says this. It's something that Venerable Panawati said when she was here that she said it up at Capitol Hill, but I always remember this. She said that we have to make sure that we know which language we're talking out of. Are we using Dhamma language or are we using common language? Because Dhamma language is not the same. We're not going to take the language of the Dhamma and then just plop it down in our lives and keep everything the same. Dhamma language is inherently designed to change our view, to restructure our values and restructure the way we think. And this is what I think this quote by Tanisaro Bhikkhu is a strong indication of that counterintuitive nature of Dhamma. He says that for happiness to be lasting, it has to be harmless. It can't take away something from someone else. It has to come from within. So whatever we do, however we see the world, if our seeking of happiness, which is going to happen, comes out of this desire for lasting harm, lasting happiness, which is based in harmlessness, then we're not going to take from anyone else in order for us to be happy. And we're going to find that happiness from within. So that's the way we're going to start seeing if we can turn this month and see if we can notice whether we're seeking our happiness taking from someone else or are we going to seek it from within. So we'll leave it there. And take a moment to be, kind of sit here and let the words kind of float away. Okay. So see if there's any questions anybody has or comments. Yep.
About the happiness, I'm passing through the flowers and it's smelling really good and I like it and it gives me momentary happiness. And I'm not going to take it away from anybody. And it just standing there to get more, just passing by.
Mm-hmm.
I still like it.
Yes. So the comment is that if I'm passing through flowers and it's beautiful, and I'm just taking in the beautiful smell and, you know, just the sight of it, I'm not really taking anything from anyone, so it's still happiness. And it's just fine. And I'm not saying that that's not happiness. And I'm not saying that it's harming. I think what Thanissaro Bhikkhu is saying is, in this wider view of learning to seek out happiness, that it's beginning to see fundamentally we're always going to seek happiness. Always, always, always going to seek happiness. If we you think the happiness of that time in the flowers is coming from the flowers, that's when we get caught in the delusion of the mind, and we can even further down the line take from another in order for us to get our happiness. The idea isn't that in the moment of your smelling the flowers, you're taking from someone else. The question is, can you see that the happiness you are getting from the flowers are not the flowers? The flowers are just neutral objects, but it's our mind that has this, that has the it has this quality of convincing us that it's coming from the flowers and the smell, and I like it. And that is the greed. So it's true that in the just the smelling flowers, you're not actually taking anything from anyone. But if you don't see how the mind is projecting its greed or desire on the flowers, then you won't be able to see that in other circumstances, which may in fact harm another or take from another. We may not see it in other ways in which we are trying to get a certain amount of money because we think the money's going to make us happy, or we're trying to get our lives fixed in such a way so we'll be happy. Do you see what I'm saying? You won't see that the same thinking mind that just pays attention thinking that it's the flowers that's calling the happiness will also have the same thoughts around money and, you know, status and reputation and everything else that we think is going to make us happy. But if you could begin to see, not that you have to not like the smell, but to begin to see that it is in the mind's thinking that this is beautiful and nice, so that you can begin to see in your own life this wisdom around thought, view and intention, you can see this wisdom in much greater context. So the neutrality of flowers is a great practice because there is no harm to anyone else. But at the same time, it's a great way to see the greed in the mind so that when some situation comes up where you can, where you do have harm to another, you could see that also. Yeah.
I just wanted to explore a little bit more the idea that for aversion and anger that you are trying to cut it off and not understand it.
Yeah.
And I'll just say, I mean, from my own practicing with anger, it's been extremely extremely helpful to observe it and see it. It kind of loses its own momentum.
Yeah.
Observation. So I don't know if that's what you're talking about, or something else when you say cut it off, because it definitely is sustained by not seeing that it's coming from within you.
Yeah. So the question is talking a little bit more about this idea that aversion and anger is around cutting off the trigger rather than understanding it. Because in many aspects, when you look at anger and you take the time to understand it, you can see its diminishing qualities. You can see how it arises and how it goes, and there's a grasping aspect to even aversion and anger, this kind of a wanting. It's almost like whenever there is an aversion, there's also a wanting or a desire in there. I think what I'm trying to, I think the reason why I'm saying that it is a cutting off of the retaliation is because metta is this kindness. I'm not saying that you want to necessarily get rid of the energy of anger, but inherent in anger and aversion is a correcting of a wrong, a fixing, a making something right. And if you get caught in trying to understand the rightness or wrongness of the making something right, then it seems like that just kind of further keeps us in the anger, both the energy and the trying to fix the wrongness of whatever that is. But if you cut off the need to retaliate, and that's what metta does, this kindness, it just brings kindness to the situation. So it brings a softening around the situation itself. You're not getting caught in whether there's a rightness or a wrongness with the situation. So it's almost like when I think about just things that have happened over the course of my life where there's a sense that someone did something wrong. My biggest problem in Buddhist practice was that somehow or another, I was supposed to let that go. Just like let the wrong go. Okay, it's not wrong anymore. So it's just everything's all good. But it's not so much that when I'm looking at aversion, that I'm trying to make everything all perfect as much as I'm trying to be able to hold the situation without the aversion to it, not the needing for something to be corrected. So even when I'm listening to you say that there's a way in which you can see the grasping after and the wanting, and you can see the petering out and the energetic flow of anger, in order to see that, there has to be that metta, this softening, kindness, capacity that happens, and then you can see the movement of action and behavior. So unlike desire, which seems more connected in the mind's habitual flow towards getting what it wants, there's a restraint there so that you can understand the craving towards something. In aversion, there is a wanting to fix, stop, avert, and it is in the kindness to not have to do that in order for us to see the nature of aversion. Do you see the difference?
Yeah.
If we just try to understand, then we can get caught in why we think we're right, and do I give up my right, and does that make them right? And instead of that, you're cutting off that need to retaliate, and that cutting off comes from kindness. And that softening, just the softening, as Bhikkhu Bodhi would say, you're substituting thoughts. You're seeing that this aversion is going to create more suffering. So you're going to substitute it for kindness. You drop the kindness in. It doesn't mean that you're not going to deal with whatever the aversion, you know, situation is. It just means you're holding it in a softer way. So I hope that you can see the difference, and so you don't get caught in the, at least this is just my own view about trying to understand when I'm angry. And it seems it's far more helpful to just be kind about it, and then you can deal with whatever comes up one way or the other. Yeah.
In my situation, it works. I have to do cutting off constantly, or, you know, sometimes 10, 20 times, and still mind wants to justify.
Yes. And that's the point that I'm trying to say. If you're not cutting off the anger, like, okay, I'm not going to be mad, because you are going to be mad. You're substituting that anger, that I'm mad, with metta. You're applying kindness to it. The kindness is what helps you actually be with the situation. If you just try to not be mad, it doesn't work. It's like, I'm just not going to desire stuff. That doesn't work. We are always going to desire. Or, you know, what's his name? Gil Fronsdal says that we should be human desirelings instead of human beings, because that's all we do is desire. So it's the same way with the aversion. I think what the point of the intention is that if you begin to insert this constant kindness in the midst of aversion, you are not trying to understand, should I be angry? Should I not be angry? Is it all okay? What should I do? You're not trying to get into all that. You're just trying to put some kindness in there. So all that negativity thought, you're just going to put some kindness in there. And then in the kindness, when that kindness begins to apply, then you can still look at the same situation. You can still not like what's going on, but you won't have all of the aversion that you're wrapped in. So that's why if at work you're constantly trying to cut off the anger, it doesn't work, because you're still angry. You still think something was done wrong and it needs to be fixed. And all you're trying to do is substitute the aversion, that sense of wanting to get retaliation, to fix it, to make it right, you're substituting that for kindness. And then in the kindness that's holding the situation, then you can deal with it. So if you keep seeing yourself constantly getting irritated and it's not working, I just get more and more and more, I'm constantly cutting it off and I'm still angry, then you got to see there's no kindness there. And that's what you want to, where, how could I bring this softening kindness kind of way? Then see if you still are caught in all the aversion. I think that's why metta is the remedy for aversion and anger. Yeah.
So, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom. Said a lot of deep things, and I've been thinking about it. It's my first time here. So my prior experience, as far as enlightenment. So, I take it with a grain of salt, but I feel like Buddhist teaching, Buddhism, is about the mind and mindfulness, but there's also a biochemical environment that gives rise to this mind, and it affects it, it shapes it, our chemistry manipulates us, you know, what we eat. Things that cause inflammation, things that cause that allows anger to rise more easily.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that, I don't see that covered in the Buddhist teaching. There's the mental layer, you know, that's covered, the mindfulness, but the lower biochemical kind of substrate is not really talked about or investigated, but that's also in
So if I... I guess what I'm hearing you say... Okay, so first of all, it takes a lot of courage to be the first time here and actually ask the question. So I want to give you props for that, right? So if I get your question, what your comment is that it seems like Buddhism is all about the thinking mind, and it doesn't take into consideration all of the sort of just the body stuff that happens in our lives that may produce a lot of that stuff that's going on in the thinking. And actually, what you're saying is probably more in line with the way I see the way Buddha talked than the way it's often talked about. I think the practice of mindfulness and Dhamma is a liberation practice. It is a purely embodied practice. So if you're always in your head analyzing everything, then it's like you say, you won't really see the truth of what's going on. You won't really see that the reason why you're having all this crazy dreams at night has more to do with the salsa you ate before you went to bed than whether or not you're jacked up or something, right? You won't see that. So the whole point is to not get caught into what the thinking mind's doing and pay attention to understanding that thinking mind. And that's going to come from the body. It's going to come from the felt sense of what's going on. I mean, if we think about things like ill will and sense pleasures and harm, all of those things from the mind's view, that's the point of what I'm making, from the mind's view, it's nothing wrong with ill will when it's a bad person. I mean, it's a bad person, so we should be having ill will about that person. Or it's sort of like we don't really care so much about the harm when it's, you know, when you deserve a little harm because you've been harmed for yourself. There's an idea that it's okay to be that way. And we don't, it's something that Joseph Goldstein said, when you think about harmlessness, think about who you will not offer compassion to. That's how you know whether or not you really are living in a harmless world. Or are you just deciding some people get compassion and some people don't? So that the whole point is to begin to drop down in the body and feel into the felt sense of harm. The felt sense of harm is going to tell you about harm more so than your thoughts about who deserves harm, or is it okay if a little harm happens, right? Or the felt sense of ill will. You start feeling the pain of that anger and that bitterness, your ability to stay angry and bitter gets much harder. But mostly we stay there because we don't even feel it anymore. And, you know, it's the same way with always running after our sense pleasures. We don't see the damage and the danger that we're doing. So we don't see the damage of food we're eating because we just happen to like it. This whole point that what I think Buddha was pointing to is that you are dropping into the body in this much more awakened world, awakened way of seeing things. And this practice, unlike just regular the secular mindfulness, this practice is more towards exactly what you're saying, liberating the mind, seeing the suffering that is generated from your own conduct or within your own body, where it's coming from. So I think that's more in line with, I think Buddhism or the practice of it is more in line with what you're saying and less in line with the intellectual discourses we kind of get caught up in sometimes. Yeah.
I had thought an experience always thought it was the negative, the anger of that people, when you go up against something, and I know who I am because I know I don't like that.
Yeah.
I'm angry at that something, whatever. And I'm realizing, I'm thinking in this society, I'm realizing that I and other people identify ourselves by our grasping. What do you grasp at? Then if there are even groups of people or categories.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only is it, I guess for myself, is my self thing occurring with the anger, but it's occurring with the grasping. And it's identified with the objects that you were saying.
That's it. Yeah, great comment. So that's the best way to end. It's this idea that you, if I can just paraphrase it, you've always thought that your selfing, this self of who I am, was connected to the aversion. And you're working on all this aversion because I don't want to be caught in the constriction of that selfing and not paying attention to the grasping after this, or I like this, or I like that. It doesn't carry with it the same sense of selfing, because it seems like inherently that's good. You know, I'm doing the good things, this is good, I'm liking this, I like that. And you're beginning to see that that is equally selfing, that is equally the same kind of limiting constriction. And when we get identified in the things that we like and the things that we're craving after and wanting. And that, I think, is the point behind right intention. It is around noticing whether this grasping or this pushing away is arising out of the basic greed, hatred, and delusion of the mind's habitual thoughts, or is it arising out of this more liberating desire for renunciation, for goodwill, and for harmlessness. And when it's arising out of those intentions, then our conduct is considered, our conduct is going to be moving towards the right conduct. When it's arising out of just our basic greed or aversion or, you know, hatred and delusion, then there is harm close on the heels, suffering close around the corner any minute. Somebody's going to be suffering. You may not, but somebody's going to be suffering from that. That's what we want to start looking at. Good. Thank you. So we better stop, or Brandon won't be getting no announcements up here.